enlightenment through God, from whom comes all counsel, wisdom, and understanding. We humbly ask you to guide and assist us in our deliberations and in our work. May all our efforts be directed to the welfare and good of our community and our country. May we act honorably in pursuit of justice for all our people, now and for the future, and for generations still to come. Amen.
Meeting of Parliament, Wednesday, 22nd July, 2015. 1. Oath of Allegiance. 2. Confirmation of Minutes. The minutes of the last meeting of Parliament, which was held on the 17th, 22nd, 23rd, 24th, and 25th of June, 2015.
May I find the minutes of correct?
Communications from the Chair.
On the 6th of July this year, the Chief Minister wrote to me the question that I wrote on the call made by the Leader of the Opposition for the Chief Minister to repeat outside Parliament what he had said in the House about him during his winding up speech at the end of the debate on the second reading of the Appropriation Bill, whereupon the Leader of the Opposition would issue defamation proceedings against him. Specifically, the Chief Minister requested that I should rule as to whether such a threat constitutes an abuse of parliamentary privilege. In this connection, I wish to refer to and place on record the ruling which my predecessor, the Honourable Major Robert Theresa, made in similar circumstances on Thursday, the 15th of February 1990. On that occasion, the Speaker ruled as follows. Matters touched upon at the last meeting of the House have given rise to correspondence being addressed to members which could inhibit their legitimate activity as elected representatives in this House of Assembly. I thus believe it prudent to bring to the attention of honourable members and the public generally the privileges with which elected members are vested for the purpose of carrying out their duties in this House, and by my doing so, discourage and dissuade people breaching these privileges, and in the process, unwittingly perhaps, making themselves liable to the consequences of any such act of contempt. Parliamentary privilege is defined in Erskine May as the sum of the peculiar rights enjoyed by each House collectively as a constituent part of the High Court of Parliament and by members of each House individually, without which they cannot discharge their functions and which exceed those possessed by other bodies or individuals. Section 36 of the Constitution of the Gibraltar Constitutional Order 1969 states, the legislature may prescribe the privileges, immunities, and powers of the Assembly and its members, but no such privileges, immunities, or powers shall exceed those of the Commons, House of Parliament, of the United Kingdom, or of the members thereof. And Part 5 of the House of Assembly Ordinance, Powers and Privileges of the Assembly State, 1661, there shall be freedom of speech and debate in the Assembly, that freedom of speech and debate shall not be liable to be questioned in any court or place outside the assembly. Section 62. No civil or criminal proceedings may be instituted against any member for words spoken before or written in a report to the assembly or to the committee thereof, or by reason of any matter or thing brought by him therein by petition, bill, resolution, motion, or otherwise. The privileges extended to members individually are far-reaching and legally complex. The subject cannot be examined widely and extensively in a short statement as the one I am making today. That is Major Pleaser. Furthermore, each situation has to be considered on its merits if and when it arises. Thus, to meet the situation that has obliged me to make this statement, I must draw attention to the freedom of speech that elected members are protected by whilst carrying out functions connected with proceedings in the House. Members are protected from interference to any form of physical, oral, or written intimidation which could be considered to obstruct members of the House carrying out the duty for which they are elected. Members who may feel being so obstructed may report the matter to the Speaker, who, taking into account the facts and circumstances of the case, will follow up the report as he may deem necessary, bearing in mind that the House collectively, in its judicial capacity, is the court that will pass the final judgment if so required. As past examples of what may constitute molestation of members on account of their conduct in the British Parliament, I quote cases embodying this type of contempt. A. Challenging a member to fight on account of their behavior in the House, or any committee thereof, or even on account of remarks made outside the House which touch proceedings in the House. B. Writing letters to members taking notice of speeches said to have been made in the House and threatening to contradict them from the gallery. C. Sending insulting letters to members in reference to their conduct in Parliament, or letters reflecting on their conduct as such members. D. Threatening to inflict pecuniary loss upon a member on account of his conduct in Parliament. E. Inciting the readers of a newspaper to telephone a member and complain of a question of which they have given notice. F. Calling the newspaper for the arrest of a member and describing him as an arch traitor. And G. Sending a letter to a member threatening him with the possibility of a trial at some future time for asking a question in the House. It will be noted from the above that conduct not amounting to a direct attempt to influence a member in the discharge of his duty, but having a tendency to impair his independence in the future performance of his duty, will also be treated as breach of privilege. This statement should make everybody aware that when any of the rights and immunities, both of the members individually and of the Assembly in its collective capacity, which are known by the general name of privileges, are disregarded or attacked by any individual or authority, the offence is called a breach of privilege or contempt, and punishable under the law of Parliament as may be applicable in debate. Such was Sir Robert Sinister's ruling. And it is my own considered view that when a member of Parliament is challenged to repeat outside his House whatever he may have said in the course of the proceedings in Parliament, there is no difference in principle whether the challenge is made by a member of the public, by a barrister acting on behalf of a member of the public, or by a member of Parliament. Accordingly, I am of the opinion that the ruling that I have read out applies in its entirety in this case. I am making available copies of the ruling and to the press as well. Now, that is the ruling that I have made. Quite apart from that ruling, under this item on the agenda of communication from the chair, there are a few words that I wish to say coming from the heart. What I've occasioned the need for this ruling has been a very acrimonious debate, in particular during the budget session, when perhaps I, as speaker, should have intervened very much earlier than in the event I did. On one instance, I asked the leader of the opposition to withdraw the word lie, and on another occasion, I fired a warning shot across the bows of the chief minister because I thought he might be in danger of contravening the standing order, which states that no improper motive must be imputed to a member. But all that is against the background of a situation when, for months, both sides of the House have been engaged in very, very heated exchanges where personal considerations have come to the fore. Personal considerations sometimes fairly short of insight. I warned honourable members, I think it was back in December or at the beginning of this year, that having regard to the fact that this was an election year, I was not going to allow such blandishment across the floor of this House. I think I failed at the last meeting. And as such, I apologize to all honourable members that perhaps I myself as Speaker was not up to speech. But then honourable members do not make my job much very easy either. And these exchanges don't just take place here, they continue outside the House. I recall that we all saw the Chief Minister and the Leader of the Opposition on television shaking hands, embracing, and promising a new dawn of more amicability. I realize that friendship at the top of politics is extremely difficult. I realize that politicians often have to be officious. But I've been a member of this House for 20 years and I've sat on both sides. And there is someone here who has done even longer than I have, twice as much. And we were on opposite sides. And we have had members of Parliament, like Sir Geoffrey Hassan and Peter Isola, who were not on speaking terms for over 10 years. And they did not use the language that I have heard here in this House in the last 6 months. I want honourable members to reflect upon my words. It is not easy to be in politics. It is not even easy to be in this chair. I dedicated my book to my family because of what they put up with for 20 years. But now that I am not in the political fray, my family are still having to put up with allegations and of that I am biased, and language that is an offence under Section 77 of the Parliament Act. And honourable members who are more involved in the political fray have to put up with much more than I do. And therefore, the question is, are we going to carry on like this? I would appeal to honourable members, in particular to the Chief Minister and the Leader of the Opposition, to draw a line about under this heated exchange. To draw a line today, I am aware of the fact, because I haven't had an opportunity to read it, but the Leader of the Opposition has written to the Chief Minister. I have not seen the letter yet. It's in my office. I need to read very carefully over the hindsight of the last meeting of Parliament during the debate. Because, as I said, I am convinced that I allowed matters to go too far and I should have intervened and called honourable members to order. Very, very strong language was used. Perhaps I should not have allowed. But, as I said, I apologise for my failing. But unless the line is drawn, I don't know what members are going to be serving at each other in 5 or 6 months' time against the background of an actual general election campaign. It doesn't make the job of the Speaker easy, and I may have to reflect myself, as other honourable members are doing, whether I am prepared to carry on. After all, what do I get out of it at this stage of my life? I don't need to be here. I can be at 87 Buena Vista Road with the hobby that I have. So, nor do I think that it will be very easy for many other people in Gibraltar to be occupying this chair the way that the manner that politics, the party politics, is being undertaken in Gibraltar. We proud, we think of ourselves as a mature community, we are proud of our democratic credentials. We have had a legislature now for 65 years. We have an excellent constitution which gives a lot of powers to the government of Gibraltar. And if we do really think that we are mature, I think that this is the place to start. Because what I hear outside Parliament and what is communicated to me from the social media doesn't lead me to believe that people could look upon Parliament and parliamentarians as what they ought to be. I pledge myself to uphold the dignity of this House when I take over office. If that doesn't happen, I may not be prepared to do so again. So I'm speaking for the heart, from my heart. If I have gone too far, if I have said something that I shouldn't, I beg pardon. I haven't found it. It is not a prepared statement. It's something that I have said. So I have asked for reflecting on what has been happening in prison.
Mr. Speaker, you have made a ruling on the communication and no comment rise on it, other than I wish to rise only to say I'm sure on behalf of the whole House that without dealing with the substance of what you said, I'm sure none of us here fear that you have failed any of us in any way or that you fail in the effort that you put into the work that you do, and to thank you for your reflections, forget your ruling, but your reflections afterwards, and to say that no doubt all of us will take it into due consideration as well.
Petitions, announcements, papers to be laid, the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to lay on the table the Consolidated Fund Claim Settlement Statement number 1 for 2013-14, the Consolidated Fund Supplementary Funding Statement number 2 for 2013-14, the Consolidated Fund Reallocation Statement number 3 for 2013-14, the Improvement and Development Fund Reallocation Statement number 1 of 2013-14, the Statement of Supplementary Estimates number 1 of 2013-2014, and the Annual Report of the Gibraltar Regulatory Authority for the year ended the 31st of March 2015.
Order to learn. The Honourable Minister for Sport, Culture, Heritage and Media.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to lay on the table the accounts for the Gibraltar Heritage Trust for the financial year ended 31st of March 2014.
Order to the Honourable Minister for Transport, Traffic and Technical Services.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to lay on the table the accounts of the Gibraltar Port Authority for the financial year ended 31st of March 2013 and the accounts of the Gibraltar Port Authority for the financial year ended 31st of March 2014.
Over to you. Report of committee, answers to all questions. We commence with question number 445 of 2015, the Honourable D.J. Rossini.
Can the Minister for Employment provide details of the registered unemployed for the final quarter of 2014 and the last two quarters of 2015?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Business and Employment.
Mr. Speaker, the number of Gibraltarians registered as unemployed is as follows. The final quarter 2014, 228. First quarter 2015, 237. The second quarter of 2015, 225.
Question number 446, the Honourable J.J. Nevin.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Health and Safety provide details of the accident investigation shown in the Gowing website for the month of June 2015 in the construction industry group?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Business and Employment.
Mr. Speaker, the matter is confidential, and whilst I'm not prepared to disclose the information across the floor of the House, I would of course be prepared to do so in private. The Honourable Member will recall that I responded in writing to a last question relating to another health and safety accident investigation in the same month.
Question. We now move to question 453. Question 453, the Honourable D. Joseph Lee.
Can the Minister for Maritime Services please advise what the cost of the recent Gibraltar Maritime Conference was?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Business and Employment on behalf of the Honourable Minister for Financial Services and Gaming.
Mr. Speaker, the total cost of the recent and very successful Gibraltar Maritime Conference was £84,633.85, the bulk of which was paid by private sector sponsorship. The cost to the government was £25,243.85. Mr. Speaker, this is a further example of the public-private sector partnership in promoting Gibraltar and her services. This is the first time ever that such an event has been organised in Gibraltar. Mr. Speaker, thanks for the answer. Has the Honourable Minister had an opportunity of receiving a report of the speech he gave? I'm not sure that he was able to attend the entirety of the conference. I know he gave an official fact, I think, on behalf of the Minister, who in fact has responsibility for that particular portfolio, Mr. Isola, who was away as the jurisdiction. But has he had an opportunity of getting a report? I attended in a professional capacity, and I was unable to attend most of them, but I did attend a Friday afternoon session, which I found very interesting. This is the reason why I chose it in the form of I was to raise this point in the form of a question, because there was a particular speech given by a young libertarian, Dean Damini, who had quite a lot to say about how we could best market Gibraltar in terms of the super yacht industry. And I would encourage him, if you haven't received a report for that particular speech, that he does, and perhaps the department, so they may be able to formulate policy in that particular area. Mr. Speaker, to answer the Honourable Gentleman's question, I have not received specifically a report from the Gibraltar Maritime Administration. I want to have read the report, I think, that appeared in the Gibraltar Chronicle, written by Irene Steele, and which I did discuss briefly with, I think it was Richard Double, and that obviously would be a full discussion to be had by the current Minister for Maritime Services, Mr. Isola, and the GMA. But certainly, the report did seem, in the Chronicle, did seem to indicate that there were some important points to consider in the way that we market the board of the yacht and the certificate. So I would agree with the Honourable Gentleman that is one report to carefully digest.
Question number 447, the Honourable J.J. Nibb.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Environment say, if any person has installed in his property any type of solar thermal system for photovoltaic panels and has had a financial reward for doing so under the Solar Energy Deduction Rules 2015?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health, the Environment and Energy.
Mr. Speaker, just before I give the formal answer, it may be that people have installed in their property which would not. I would not be aware of, but the substantive answer in relation to the financial assistance is no, sir. No one has applied for financial assistance yet. They may have installed, but they have not applied for financial assistance.
Of course, I mean, that's entirely true. People may have done it installed long before the actual came into force. But ever since the rules have been imposed now, no one has applied. But the thing is, the administration set up is already geared towards considering the application, and if it's successful, obviously, they will get the reward.
Yes, the rules were passed relatively recently, and it may not have given time for it to sink in. But the department is going to be promoting this as part of its energy efficient campaign in coming months.
Because we're going to be able to do the system.
we wouldn't expect to see clearing until probably the next financial year, the next tax year, sorry, in the sense that people will be submitting their claim with their tax return. And so it's likely that at this CCC, and people then decide they want to do the work, then they would be able to make their application when they submit tax returns. And I think that's when we will likely be able to make a better assessment of the success of the measure and of the promotion of it if they likely follow through.
Great, thank you. Question number 448, the Honourable J.J. Mitchell.
Can the Minister for Environment say what are the key objectives set for 2015 by the current Climate Task Force?
I'll answer the Honourable Minister for Health, the Environment and Energy.
The key objectives, which are long term and not specifically for 2015, set by the Climate Change Task Force, have included the Renewable Energy Strategy and the Decarbonisation of the Energy Sector Action Plan, not yet completed. These documents are currently in the final stages of review by Task Force members. I will, however, give some of the main objectives here. The key Task Force draft conclusions or recommendations are 1. To achieve carbon neutrality as soon as possible. 2. Decarbonisation of electricity supply and lowering of the carbon footprint of transport. 3. Is adoption and development of energy transition in the direction of renewables. 4. Energy efficiency. 5. Sharing of responsibility between the private and private and public sectors. 6. Cost effectiveness. And 7. The possibility of energy access.
Question number 449, the Honourable J.J. Mitchell.
Can the Minister for Environment state by when will the renewed tender process, as stated by the Honourable Minister in the budget address, for the waste treatment facility land, and by when does the Minister expect works to commence?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health, the Environment and Energy.
Speaker, my understanding is that the technical review of the tender submission is due to be completed in the next couple of weeks. The Board will then convene and assess the submission and report. I expect this will happen in August, and depending on the recommendations, awards should then follow. On average, such chances will take 1.5 to 2 years to complete from date of commission. But again, we will not be able to confirm this until the successful tender is closed.
Question number 450, the Honourable J.J. Mitchell.
Can the Minister for Environment say where will the new eco park be situated and provide planning with an update in relation to the facilities provided therein?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health, the Environment and Energy.
Mr. Speaker, the eco park will be launched imminently. I believe I have a press call sometime this week about it. It will be the Devil's Tower Road area and it will provide a one stop shop for all waste streams. These include, but are not limited to, scrap metal, bulky items, compressed gases and ozone depleting substances, vehicle decontamination, glass, batteries, paper and cardboard, paint, tires, mixed packing, recycling, waste, electrical and electronic equipment, lighting and waste oil.
Question number 451, the Honourable J.J. Mitchell.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Environment state that there has been an employee of the Department of Environment who has been found to have had a prohibited drug within the premises of the Department?
I am for the Honourable Minister for Health, the Environment and Energy.
Mr. Speaker, there has been no such incident.
Mr. Speaker, what is it perhaps the case that instead of being a prohibited drug, a report was issued to the financially that an employee may have had a prescriptive drug, and as a result of that, a report was issued within the department?
Mr. Speaker, I have no knowledge of a prescriptive drug. The question refers to a prohibited drug, and I have answered that, but I suspect that the answer would be identical if it had been a prescriptive drug. I have no knowledge of any such incident.
Mr. Speaker, I'm
However, if it was a prescription drug with prescription, then therefore there would have been no issue. If somebody's had a cold or some infection and they have antibiotics with them, there's no issue there. But I certainly, the implication is something a little bit more sinister than that, and certainly I have no information on that whatsoever, or even heard a rumor.
Yes, indeed, but there are on occasions particularly prescriptive drug, or perhaps a better word, pharmaceutical drug, which may have an impact on the work that a particular employee may do. Whether it's a particular drug that may improve the person conducting a vehicle or work with that experience. But isn't perhaps not the case that a report was issued by the department, which in a number of ways related to this issue, and also in another way related to the fact that this individual may not have been in actual case of work where he should have been, and perhaps that was the reason why the parliamentary report was issued as a result of these issues jointly.
I think I have no knowledge of that. I think it's really speculation. If the honourable member has any indication that something improper has occurred, then I suggest that he contact me and it should be looked into, but I have no such report, and I don't believe that my department has issued any such report.
Indeed, I haven't had a situation where recently, in the last weeks or months, there has been a volition opposed to one particular entry of the department environment, which may have had a relationship to the issues that I'm raising now.
Mr. Speaker, I have answered my question. I don't think this is a legitimate supplementary. I have answered my question factually, and I have gone even beyond what I have been asked, and therefore I would need notice of any other question which is so different to the one that I have correctly and honestly answered.
Question number 452, the Honourable J.J. Newton. Mr. Speaker, given the imminent opening of a dementia centre at the OIMH, can the Minister for Health say the opening date of the centre and whether the appointed staff has been completed, stating which grades may be deployed from existing resources within the DHA or the care agency, which grades will be new employment opportunities, and provide a new annual recurring cost as a result of the opening of the facility?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health, the Environment and Energy.
The Speaker, the date for opening of the Dementia Centre for this place has not yet been set and is subject to commissioning and planning as an all-task body. The assets which will be redeployed to the new centre may include the memory clinic and related activities subject to final confirmation. Various models of care are currently being considered so that the full details are not yet available.
The only reason why I've asked this particular question was because I believe that either the Minister for Health or the Minister for Social Services, I can't remember what in their budget speeches or perhaps the month before, made a statement to the effect of saying we are planning to have this facility open in the month of August. Month of August is only a couple of weeks from now, hence the reason that my particular question. If it's still the view that the facility will be ready by August.
Mr. Speaker, this is why I started my question by saying that it is subject to commissioning and snagging, which in all building projects, particularly some of that specialized nature, can always delay the actual commissioning date. Therefore, although August, end of August is still our end, it may be that it will still take a few weeks.
Yes, but even accepting, you know, that all construction projects have delays, and this is going to be the first one. But whether it's at the end of August or the first few weeks in September, we are really basically talking about between 4 to 6 weeks from now, basically. I would have imagined that by now, the government would have had a very clear picture in relation to, not the snagging, but in terms of the facilities to be provided, the kinds of staff and personnel that would be there deployed to make sure that the facility works in accordance to the plan that the management has in place.
and by saying it through the known, well, we need so many people of this particular grade, and so many people of this type of professional, and all of these cost X amount of money. I mean, where is the going in relation to knowing the grades, the professionals, the cost, etc.?
I think that everywhere I've got into this, but some of the services provided, we are looking at outsourcing, and we are at the moment considering expressions of interest from, I think, 6 or 7 providers, each with their own model and each with their own proposals, which need to be adjusted. So, therefore, there are a variation of possibilities. And funding more than calculated in the appropriation bill for the centre. So, that's not an issue. The issue is that we're looking at different possible models and also which services, for example, the memory clinic is the most likely, will be transferred to the new site using existing staff. And this tweaking is actually, obviously, is very laborious, and we've got to get it right. And I believe that all that will be properly done and completed by the time that the commissioning of the building has taken effect.
Let me see if I understand this clearly. The facility in the main building itself, will that be manned by either or manned and managed both by DHA staff or the care agency, or will that be constructed out? Or is the minister saying that there are some facilities, like the memory clinic, which will not be housed in the main building, and such facilities or others are the ones that the government is considering constructing out?
Well, I'm saying, speaker, that we're looking at models in which, for example, care and so on is likely to be outsourced. Specific, more specialized, like the memory clinic, which is doctor-led and specialist nurse-led, will continue to be GHA, but would be carried out in the RMA site instead of where it's carried out now. In the new site, instead of where it is now, which is in Coney Island, or something which is in Buenos Aires. So there will be some movement of, which will vacate areas for other development, will be some movement to this site. Then there will be other specialized, for example, the doctor who will attend will be a DHA doctor, but the care positive and so on, sorry, not care positive, the care and so on, we are considering, as I said, 6 or 7 proposals for outsourcing of the care and related activities. So we'll be obviously an overall management from the elderly residential services or the health authority, but this is the model that we're looking at.
Question number 454, the Honourable Dean Josephine.
Can the Minister for Employment please provide the names of the government companies which are currently providing employment during the pregnancy as part of the FDS?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Economic Development and Telecommunications.
I assume because the Honourable Member wants me to answer, no, he's going to take away my job from me and give it to somebody else. The Honourable Member has had the names of the companies involved since 2012.
Just what I wanted to start with is whether there have been any new additions to that or any removals of the company. I don't see anything, but if it's that's how they did reply back in 2012, then I'm happy with the answer.
So. Question number 455, the Honourable D.A. Keeper. Mr. Speaker, can the Chief Minister please state what the government cash reserves were as of the 30th of June 2015? I'm the Honourable Minister for Economic Development and Telecommunications.
I will answer this question with question 456 to 459.
Question number 456, the Honourable D.A. Peterson.
Cameron Smith, please give a breakdown by bank and amount of that part of the aggregate public debt that comprises transfers as at the 30th of June 2015.
Question 457, the Honourable D.A. Simpson.
Can the Chief Minister please provide this House with a breakdown by the venture issue of that part of the aggregate public debt which comprises government debentures as at the 30th of June 2015?
Question number 458, the Honourable D.A. Simpson.
Can the Chief Minister please provide details of the value of Gibraltar Savings Bank debentures or aggregate security as at the 30th of June 2015?
Question number 459, the Honourable D.A. Simpson.
Mr. Speaker, can the Chief Minister please provide a breakdown of where and how all the money deposited in the Gibraltar Savings Bank has been invested and the rate of return on each of these investments as at the 30th of June 2015?
I'm the Honourable Minister for Economic Development and Telecommunications.
Mr. Speaker. As of the 1st of June, the government cash reserves was £28,180,000. The aggregate public debt consisting of bank debt was Barclays Bank $150 million and NatWest for $450 million. Government debentures were as follows: 1 month notice £247,700,000. The value of the Gibraltar Savings Bank debentures and other debt security by maturity date was 1 month, £33,164,200. 2015 debentures, £6,072,400. 2016 debentures, £22,833,800. 2017 debentures, £101,214,500. 2018 debentures, £163,570,600. 2019 debentures, £205,566,000. Other debentures, £159,044,093. Bonds, £70,594,812. And deposit accounts, £186 million. The average yield in respect of the different categories of investment vehicles held by the savings bank for the month of May are as follows. On call accounts of the Bank of England, the Crown Agent, and Gibraltar Bank have an average yield of 0.55%. The Gibraltar Bank, the Royal Bank of Scotland, Barclays Bank, National Westminster, Ulster Bank, and Lloyds Bank. Floating rate notes quoted on the London Stock Exchange now have a slightly higher yield of 1.02%. The floating rate notes are issued by the following: European Investment Bank and International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, Nedbank Bank, KHW, Republic of Finland, Volkswagen Financial Services, Dexia, GE Capital UK, Westpac Securities, Australia, New Zealand Bank Group, Centrica PLC, OSB Finance, Royal Bank of Canada, BG Energy Capital PLC, Suncorp Network Limited, BMW Finance, and National Grid Gas PLC. Monthly income debentures at a 6% return and preferences in credit finance, an average dividend of 5.7%. As previously explained, corporate stocks and on-call accounts fluctuate marginally on a daily basis. These fluctuations are not significant. I now hand over to the Honourable Member the schedule of the Savings Bank statement listing the investments for a month.
I wonder whether the Honourable Gentleman can help me with this. According to my calculations, gross public debt is at the figure that has been for the last several months, $437 million. Cash reserves are $28.8 million. I hope I've heard the Honourable Gentleman correctly. That means that the net debt is $418.2 million. Can you confirm that to the level of net debt as at the 30th of June 2015?
Correct. Yes.
And of course, Mr. Speaker, it's the highest level of public debt that we've ever had in the political history of this community. And Speaker, in the light of the fact that it's the highest net debt that we've ever had in the political history of this community, and in the light of the fact that the Honourable Gentleman in his manifesto has a commitment certainly to reduce the gross debt by half from the levels that it was, so roughly he's going to have to reduce the gross debt from 447 to 260 million. Do you feel that in the light of these levels of net public debt, which are the highest that they've ever been in the history, that he is still on course and on target to reduce that gross debt to 260 million pounds?
Well, first of all, speaker, there is no reference in the manifesto to net debt, as you know, and I know. Secondly, it used to be the mantra of a member's office that it was the height of economic illiteracy to talk about debt in absolute terms and not as a percentage of the GDP. And therefore, if he wants to do it in the way he used to do when he was in government, he should look at the figures of the percentage of the GDP. And certainly, if you are an optimist, I expect to be on target.
Mr. Speaker, but in the light of that, I have to say that I am gratified to see him that he too, according to the people of he too, has had this damaging conversion, and now he's urging upon me what we used to urge upon him on his side, which was don't look at debt in absolute terms, look at it as a percentage of the economy, and look at net debt rather than gross debt. So if you, in the light of what he's just told me, accepting that their entire political district in 4 years of being in opposition and making all those arguments about high levels of public debt, but really that was misconceived and that really what we should be talking about, and that we were correct indeed in talking about net debt as a percentage of the economy.
Not to the same degree that it was discussed in 2003 was misconceived. When he argued that gross debt of 89 million was excessive, irrespective of the level that is represented. So, in fact, I don't think he ever used the mantra of the percentage of GDP until he became the leader of the party and the leader of the opposition. So, if these things have been converted to it, I can only be following in his footsteps because the conversion happened to him before it happened to me.
So, Mr. Speaker, we have all, according to him, been converted. I am doubly justified, Mr. Speaker, that we have both been committed. But let me in my own defense say that was not the point that I made in 2003. He knows that. The point I made in 2003 was that the public debt was 89 million, that the level of the ceiling of public debt at the time, the pre-constitution, was 100 million pounds. And that the then government had had a PFI arrangement, which was an off-balance sheet transaction, and that if you took that into account, that they would have probably taken it over the 100 million pound limit. That was the argument that I raised in 2003. By the way, Mr. Speaker, I am happy that he has converted to our policy in this regard, but I wonder whether he can at least enlighten this House on how he is going to be reducing gross public debt from £447 million to £260 million, which is their manifesto commitment, which no doubt they remind that they sing from the rooftop that all their manifesto commitments are going to be met, that this one is going to be met. And I just wonder whether he can explain that to the House.
First of all, I haven't said I've been converted. I said if I had been converted, I would only be following his conversion. So it's either a good thing to be converted,
that has happened to him, and not the bad things that happened to me, but I haven't been converted. I am telling him that as far as we are concerned, the manifesto commitment that we are targeting is still one we expect to achieve, and I certainly have no intention of explaining to him how we're going to do it, because our function is to believe what we say, but not to teach the honorable members how they can do it as well if they ever happen to be back on this part of life.
Doesn't the honorable, I just wonder whether for all time's sake, at the very least, he might be prepared to accept that. Doesn't he think that that is a tad unfair? They reminded him, being a Muslim, that would be debated later, asking me how we were going to be doing something about community care. Well, I'm asking, well, how are you going to be reducing this to 260? I mean, you know, I mean, I can tell the honorable member, I mean, who's prejudging that, but I have no intention of changing this policy in relation to community care if I continue to be the leader of the community. I can tell him that, and I'll be straight with him. Now, doesn't he, in the light of that, for all time's sake, let's say, at least want to volunteer how he's going to be reducing your public debt from 447 to 260, bearing in mind that the net debt, and there is a correlation between the two, is the highest that it's ever been in the political history of Gibraltar by the election.
Well, the relevance of whether it's high in the political history of Gibraltar or not is as far as I'm concerned a matter of judgment, and I'm certainly not prepared to give him any information as to how it's going to be achieved for old time's sake, because the old time is now so far back that I wouldn't want to go back that far.
Question number 460, the Honourable DJ Rafini.
Will the Chief Minister provide a report to the House of matters discussed with the Chairman of the United Nations Committee of Committee 4?
Thank you, the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I'm not prepared to say more publicly at this stage. A note of the meeting is being prepared by the Office of the Chairman of the Committee of 24, which I understand the Secretariat of the Committee of 24 will circulate to all its members. I'm happy to sit down, however, with the Honourable Gentleman and provide full details to him privately of the discussion that ensued. It may be that in the future I can say more publicly, but at this stage I would be happy to share more privately. And Mr. Speaker, I want to take this opportunity to thank Mr. Bassano and Dr. Althea for their important input during that meeting. Gibraltar sometimes doesn't seem to realize the important resource that we have in both of them. Dr. Garcia's historical understanding of the post-war politics of Gibraltar is unrivaled, and I know the questioner has as high a regard for the Deputy Chief Minister's knowledge and ability as I do, although I've been politically clever enough to stick with him and he has not. And moreover, Mr. Speaker, Mr. Bassano's own expertise in self-determination matters is not only second to none, but seen by many members of the C24 as unparalleled. I will share publicly with honourable members that Chairman Mendoza was highly complimentary during our meeting of Mr. Bassano's knowledge of the United Nations decolonization subject, and indicated how much he himself had learned from Mr. Bassano's interventions in the seminars organised by the Committee of 24 since he became chairman.
Mr. Speaker, can you at least enlighten the House as to whether, as to what reply he received from the chairman when he renewed the invitation for a visiting mission?
Well, Mr. Speaker, didn't say no.
Question number 461, the Honourable D.A. Peterson.
Mr. Speaker, can the government please state what has been the outcome of the investigation as to the leak of the text affairs of the previous Speaker of this House?
Answer the Honourable Chief Minister.
And Mr. Speaker, the position remains the same as was set out in my answer to question 619 of 2014. However, I am advised by the Chief Secretary who has carried with these matters that he will shortly be requesting the Commissioner of Police to carry out an investigation into the leak of the tax affairs of the previous Speaker of the House.
Question number 462, the Honourable D.A. Peter.
Mr. Speaker, is the government now in a position to state how many people of those that have been naturalised British and Gibraltar since the 9th of December 2011 have obtained government housing?
Answer the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, since the 9th of December 2011, one such applicant has obtained a government housing, and the reference he received to such an applicant so that it's clear, and I think it gives him the answer he was speaking when he was debated.
Question number 463, the Honourable D.A. Peaton.
Can the government please state what are the criteria for determining whether the financial claim either brought or defended by government ministers should be funded by the taxpayer, and whether that criteria applies to other members of Parliament?
Answer the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, my answer remains as set out in answers to questions 430 and 515 of 2013.
Mr. Speaker, is the taxpayer funding legal representation, and I have to declare an interest in the representation appears to be provided by my friend, that it's relevant. This is really the question of whether the taxpayer is funding that representation against Gareth Jingle, or is the Honourable Gentleman paying it out of his own pocket?
The Honourable Gentleman is asking a question about a matter which is on foot. I'm quite happy to deal with it, but where we go with this debate is something that I think we have to be particularly cautious with. The Chief Minister was seeking representation as to things that were said about him in respect of his office as of his discharge of the office of Chief Minister. And in keeping with the principles set out in the questions I referred the Honourable Gentleman to, that is a matter that is funded for the Chief Minister by the public press. It is absolutely right and proper, it should be.
Mr. Speaker, I had occasion to go to the United Kingdom, travel the United Kingdom, to take advice from specialist counsel in the United Kingdom about statements that the Honourable Chief Minister made, not in this House, but in fact, in a comment that he made outside the House, saying that he stood by everything that he said inside the House, as to whether that represented a republication of defamatory of comments. And that obviously applied to me in my capacity as leader of the opposition, because the comments were made to me in my capacity as leader of the opposition. Now, what are the criteria for a leader of the opposition to actually be able to receive the same treatment as a Chief Minister of Gibraltar and ask the Chief Secretary, well, can the public not fund any advice that the leader of the opposition has received in relation to any potential claim against the Chief Minister of Gibraltar?
Mr. Speaker, I don't have similar issues in the answer to questions 430 and 540 of 2015, which I invite the Honourable Member to revisit. I'm conscious of the words that you shared with us at the beginning of the session. I don't intend to say more.
Answer to written questions, the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I enclose answer. I have the honour to table the answers to written questions numbered W82 to W85 of 2015 inclusive.
order of the day.
Mr. Speaker, I now have the honour to move that the House be now adjourned till Monday, the 27th of July at 3:30 in the afternoon.
Mr. Speaker, my wife is travelling on Monday, Monday morning, within Spain for an operation in her leg. I'm then going to be travelling back with her, so it's not possible for me to cancel an operation for my wife, which is for health reasons. And therefore, if it's going to be the termination of emotions, I need to be here. And if there is any parliamentary business that can be undertaken without me, that's fine. And if you decide to plow ahead, that's fine. But of course, I cannot cancel an operation that my wife is having, which is for health reasons, which has been booked. Not on the relevant week when we have Parliament, and I ask him to bear that in mind and in the room.
Of course, Mr. Speaker, and there's no question of us standing in the way of any operation, most of which are for health reasons. And therefore, Mr. Speaker, I would propose that we instead come back on Tuesday the 28th at the same time.
And I propose a question that this House is now adjourned to Tuesday the 28th of July at 2:30 in the afternoon. I now put a question that this House is now adjourned to Tuesday the 28th of July at 2:30 in the afternoon. I can tell you, I agree, the House is now adjourned to Tuesday the 28th of July at 2:30 in the afternoon.